I am here with Jonah Goldberg. Jonah, thanks for joining me.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, it's great to see you again. So I'm sure there's a lot to talk about. Let's remind people, first of all, where they can find most of your stuff to read online, and how do you describe what you do and where you are these days?
Sure. I'm the editor-in-chief of The Dispatch, which Steve Hayes and I launched about 6 years ago because we wanted to sort of model behavior that wasn't too much on display in American journalism, particularly in right-of-center journalism. And so we are unapologetically right-of-center. We have some left-of-center writers as well, but we are kind of, we pride ourselves on being fact-driven, and we're sort of violently nonpartisan, so we're perfectly happy to talk about how the Republican Party is a shit show. Mm. And so The Dispatch is the best place to find me. I'm an LA Times columnist, have been for almost 2 decades, and I've got a podcast called The Remnant. So there you go.
Nice. Nice. Well, let's start with Trump 2.0. How's it going? How is the first, 7 months, almost 8 months been in your view? What has surprised you? What is better than you thought, worse than you thought?
Yeah, so that's a good question. I have to admit, I was wrong about some things. I, like a lot of people, thought that we would see more continuity with the first term, for good and for ill, than we have. I had this theory, I may even floated it on here, that the kind of mass deportation he was promising is too big of a lift logistically and politically for him to pull off. Mm. I don't think he still hasn't gotten to where he sort of promised to go, but he's gotten closer to it than I thought he would. I have to say, I've been surprised at his remarkably quick success in shutting down the border. I think if he were smart politically, he would talk about that a lot more and stop doing a lot of the other stuff that he does. Mm-hmm. I've been surprised by the really sort of complete feckless confusion of Democrats in all sorts of ways and how to counter him.
Yeah.
I also, you know, but the thing that I was wrong about was more that I thought that in his first term, the condo salesman part of his presidency was much more pronounced insofar as he liked the headline. He liked to promote the headline. He liked to claim total victory. He would tell people he actually built the wall. He claimed that he completely tore up NAFTA, when in reality, he basically just added a couple, you know, new provisions to an updated NAFTA and kept it. But he got to claim that he did something huge, right? And this time around, I've been shocked to the degree to which there's more substance for good or for ill to a lot of his stuff. I never thought DOGE would work, and it didn't, but it did a lot of damage. There was a lot of performative vandalism to it.
Yeah.
And I guess the thing I'm sort of most shocked by, it's hard, I should have made a list, but I guess the thing I'm most shocked by is the cavalier way a lot of people just sort of price in the corruption. And I don't necessarily just mean like the crypto stuff and the Bitcoin stuff and taking a plane from the Qataris and all of those sort of obvious things. You know, corruption has a richer, more redolent meaning than the sort of just bribe-taking kind of connotation to it. The corruption of sort of the way the system is supposed to work, the, you know, one of the things that's good about hypocrisy that people don't really appreciate is that even lip service to an ideal that you fall short of maintains this idea that the ideal should be an ideal, right? Like, yeah. Wayne Booth, the literary critic, says that rhetoric is the art of probing what men believe men ought to believe. And so the fact that Trump has been so successful in just dispensing with the pretense of doing the right thing some of the time, and people cut him slack for it, you know, this idea that you're going to fill the government with loyalists where you make them take loyalty tests, and everyone says, well, that's just Trump. That's what people voted for. The idea that you're going to put some truly unqualified people in power solely because they're loyal, that's the kind of thing that, look, loyalty tests are a thing in politics and have been for thousands of years, and they're never going away. But the pretense that you're doing things for other reasons is usually cover for it. And here, there's a lot of crap he's doing that they're just owning it. And that's been pretty shocking to me.
Yeah, that point about hypocrisy is a deep one. I think it was this La Rochefoucauld maxim, right, that hypocrisy is the tribute that vice plays to virtue.
Right.
And it's making the same point that you're only truly capable of hypocrisy if you're to some degree granting the importance of certain norms tacitly. So it's by reference to those norms that you can be convicted of hypocrisy. But there's just no pretense of normativity at all with these guys. You know, the one thing, I mean, Trump lies about everything under the sun. He's a massive imposter and has been for in so many respects. You know, he pretended to be rich when he wasn't rich, et cetera, but he's never pretended to be a good person, right? He's not a hypocrite in that sense. And I think that's some key to his charm for at least half of America.
Yeah, I'm kind of curious what you think about this, because I often try to explain this point to people, and they look at me the way my basset hound used to look at me when I tried to feed it a grape, with just sort of head tilting, total incomprehension. I see Trump in many ways as almost a culmination of postmodernism, right? And we can stay on the hypocrisy thing for just a second. You know, as a friend of mine once said, when Hugh Hefner moved out of the Playboy mansion to raise little kids, no one criticized him for failing to live down to his principles, right? Like in a healthy society, the hypocrisy thing about upholding the ideals is important because it still keeps the standard alive. And the cult of authenticity, which is more from Romanticism than postmodernism, but they overlap, says, no, the highest version of truth, the highest version of legitimacy comes from within, that you just have to be true to yourself. And that's why I think our culture for the last 50 years has been so obsessed with notions of hypocrisy. But I always used to say, you know, if a glutton says everyone should overeat, that he's being true to himself, but he's giving terrible advice. It's better to say, don't do what I do, right? The essence of good parenting is to say, you know, is not to sort of teach your kids to make the same mistakes you made, but to say, I learned from some things and we're going to set some standards and do as I say, not as I did. And Trump, I think, comes partly from Norman Vincent Peale and the power of positive thinking upbringing that he had, and partly from his just, you know, malignant narcissism. He has this approach to the universe, which is to say that his feelings are determinative of reality. We just saw this last week with the firing of the BLS commissioner. It's critical Trump theory, right? If any external truth or standard undermines his desires, his will to power, his preferences, it must not only be corrupt or rigged, as he would put it, but it must be specifically rigged against him, that it's bigoted against Trump, right? When Barr told him, we looked into these allegations that the election was stolen and there's no evidence to it, Trump's response wasn't go look again or show me the facts. It was, you must hate Trump. Because he doesn't speak the vernacular of, you know, Foucault reading campus radicals or anything like that. And because he's so naked in his appetites and his agenda, people don't see it, that in many ways, it's a kind of horseshoe theory thing where he's living down to this cult of authenticity thing, and it gets him off the hook. People will say, that's just Trump being Trump, as if an explanation is the same thing as an excuse.
Yeah, well, there's this phrase that is gaining some currency among the commentariat, which is the woke right, you know, or the postmodern right. And the claim seems to be that the right has learned, if not explicitly by osmosis, from the success of wokeness on the far left, that you can essentially take all of your political assertions off the gold standard of reality testing and truth claims and intellectual honesty, and it's just all a matter of just the mimetics of what will win. I mean, what narrative can you force into people's brains on social media? Who can you smear successfully? And yeah, then there's just whatever sticks, and it's just a set of power relations, right? You're worried about who has power, who's going to benefit from anything being established as true, as opposed to whether or not it is true. And yeah, it does vindicate at least this part of horseshoe theory. I mean, I guess there's anti-Semitism also vindicates it. If you go far enough left or right, you meet anti-Semites of a different flavor.
Yeah.
But the resemblance of the political extremes to one another is in the lack of principles and the conspiracy thinking and the willingness to really break all of the norms that allow for sane, rational compromise. Yeah, it seems to be there, and it just is self-evident. Yeah.
I used to be a big critic of horseshoe theory, and I'm still willing to defend my old criticisms, but I've had to say times have changed, and I've changed my mind about it. Insofar as I used to defend the American right and conservatism, and I still defend the conservatism that I believe in on these grounds. It's just that my conservatism isn't very popular these days. But, you know, American conservatism is liberal in the classical liberal sense. It is right. The heart of the American conservative movement in my lifetime was defending, you know, the founding fathers and the Constitution, free market capitalism, all of these things that stem out of 18th and 19th century classical liberalism. And a big chunk of the American center left is classically liberal too. I mean, they have a little too much Rawls in it for me, but that's a different conversation. And what kind of just dawned on me is like, I always thought that the right would not let go of those commitments. And it turns out that the reason why horseshoe theory works is the second you stop being liberal, right, in the classical liberal sense, you know, individual rights, the sovereignty of facts, the liberal of liberal arts, right? That's the kind of liberal I'm talking about. This idea that rules and rights are sovereign, that the individual is key, that conscience rights are important, that we don't judge people as members of groups, but on their own actions and based on their own arguments and facts and all that. The second you abandon that, whether you do it for a culturally loaded left-wingism or a culturally loaded right-wingism, the salient point is it's illiberal.
Yeah.
And illiberalisms, it's sort of like in particle physics, you know, you got different, they start giving these different things, different tiny little flavors to explain the differences of them. But at the end of the day, like illiberalism is illiberalism. And the differences between them boil down to flavors and aesthetics, and also which constituencies you want to reward, right? Which powers, which groups you want to elevate and which you want to denigrate. But in terms of like respect for rights and facts and logic and reason and conscience and all that kind of stuff, the different forms of illiberalism are all remarkably similar.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they're both tribal, right? You're fighting for your tribe, and there's no pretense of the universality of your commitments, you know? So, I mean, to be actually ethical, to be saying something is good or something is evil, really, it can't just be, it's that way because you are you, part of your group, or you have your skin color. I mean, you have to be making a claim that's generalizable to people regardless of identity. But once you give up that criterion and you just think identity is everything, then yeah, there's no reason to respect expertise. I mean, obviously, expertise is a sham. That's just another power relation. Institutions don't have to be preserved. We don't, you know, as you go far enough left and far enough right now, you meet people who don't seem to think there's much of anything worth preserving in our society, right? So it's definitely not conservative. The further right you go, you meet the tear it all down brigade, you know, just as surely as you meet them on the left.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. And one of the arguments, I apologize if we talked about this last time I was on here, but one of the arguments that drives me crazy is this claim, which you get from a lot of people on what they call the common good constitutionalism. It's one of these post-liberal right-wing intellectual niches. And the argument that they like to make, which has its analogs in the arguments that the Trump administration makes all the time, is that the Constitution, and by extension, the rule of law, but the Constitution is a morally neutral document. And I find this really grotesque because, first of all, where the Constitution is neutral, that neutrality itself is profoundly moral, right? This idea that the reason why justice is blind is that you're not supposed to pick favorites by the color of the skin of people walking to the courtroom, right? But at the same time, you know, the idea that you have the right to confront your accuser, right? That was one of the most hard-won moral victories for humanity, right? The idea that you should be secure in your papers and your properties and you have a right to privacy and all these kinds of things, that is not morally neutral. And it's very easy to see how it's not morally neutral if you feel like it when it's violated. You know, if you start thinking about the Fifth Amendment or the First Amendment, the right to speak your conscience without punishment, right? The right to worship as you please, to associate as you please. We take these things for granted, which is a shame. But taking them for granted is not the same thing as thinking that they're morally neutral.
No.
This is what makes Western democracies morally superior to totalitarian and authoritarian regimes of the right or the left, right? Yeah. The fact that we recognize these things, but this tribal thing that you get on the post-liberal right says, no, because they don't reward the things that we like and they allow for the freedom of people we disagree with, that's a suicide pact and we got to get rid of it. And I think it's that's what's suicidal is that kind of thinking.
Mm. So what do you make of Trump's apparent failure to put the Epstein mess behind him in a way that is as efficient as his dispatch of most of the scandals he's had to deal with?
So I'm glad we've moved on from the philosophical stuff for a little bit. So I think the Epstein thing is kind of fascinating. All right, we'll just do this as political punditry just for a second. Part of what we're seeing here is it dawning on the various hotbeds of MAGA, social media, podcast bros, whoever, right? Steve Bannon. It's dawning on them that Trump's not going to be around forever. And the Epstein story is just too good, right? It's got, I mean, it is, as my friend David French says, it's something like, he calls it the thinking man's QAnon, right? And it just checks so many boxes and scratches so many erogenous zones. It's got this perfidious Jewish guy at the head of it, right? And he's in the shadowy globalist world of banking and all of this kind of thing. And it's got pedophilia and sexual depravity, which, you know, is always a big theme of the QAnon crowd. And to let go of it means that you can't use it down the road, say in the Republican primaries or in the post-Trump era. And so part of it, I think, is like a bunch of people are realizing this topic is just too damn monetizable to let go of. That's part of it. There's also the fact that it's just too damn juicy, right? And people like Dan Bongino and Kash Patel, they have invested so much of their identity in these stories that they're presented with, and for listeners, I assume they know, head of the FBI and the number two guy at the FBI, that for them to say, oh, we were just, there was nothing there, puts them in this incredible bind, which I find utterly justified and delicious, because either the only choices are, we were lying to you all along, or we were full of crap all along, right? Maybe the it could be one or both of those. I think they're both, but we were gaslighting you all along, and now we're telling you the truth, or we were telling you the truth before, and now we're lying to stay in power. And that rubs up against this whole sort of anti-deep state, anti-establishment thing. It creates excruciating problems for them. And the fact that Trump has had such a hard time putting it to bed, I mean, it's kind of gone to bed now. It's taking a nap. I don't think it's gone. Shows how fraught creating a mass movement based on a cult of personality is, because you've got this massive coalition that is only unified basically around one thing. It's Donald Trump. And that's not an ideological coalition. That's not a political coalition. That's not even a coalition of interests properly understood. It is purely a grift about a cult of personality. And the fact that you can see that he can't hold it all together on when it comes to an issue like this is fascinating. Now, as for why he wants it to go away, I'll just be clear. I don't think we're ever going to get evidence that he was on the blackmail list. I don't think there was a blackmail list. I don't think there's going to be any evidence that he was sleeping with underage girls. And the reason I think that is not because I have a high view of Donald Trump's character. It's because if that stuff existed, there is no way the Biden administration, the New York District Attorney's Office, or the Justice Department generally wouldn't have weaponized it. When they were putting Donald Trump on trial for the stupid bank, you know, business records thing, and that kind of stuff, if they had this and opted not to use it, that would be utterly bizarre. The idea that it wouldn't leak is utterly bizarre. At the same time, do I think there's embarrassing stuff in there for Trump? Absolutely. And I think that's probably enough. And he deserves all the grief he gets for it because he's covering up something that he's told his people for years. Any government cover-ups of something is proof of some conspiracy. And now he's covering up something that he said he was going to release. So it would sort of take a heart of stone not to laugh at all of it.
Yeah. No, my Schadenfreude circuits have been humming along for at least a month now.
So,
I mean, the only time I can remember Trump getting sideways with his cult in this sort of way that was kind of briefly surprising, and then he never touched that again, I think, was when he, in front of some crowd, it might have been CPAC, I don't know where he was, but he took credit for the vaccines.
Yeah.
And he got booed.
Yeah.
Right. And that was just this first moment, really. I mean, and I think not to be repeated until the Epstein mess, where it was just clear that, okay, his cult, it's all about him, except there are a few things they really do care about.
Yeah.
And if he seems to see those things differently, that's a potential problem for him, right? So they really were against the vaccine, more or less to a man at that point. And so for him to take credit for it as though it were a good thing, that was just too much cognitive dissonance. They erupted in boos. And here, it seems like, yeah, they know he lies about everything, or they pretend not to know that he lies about everything. But here's a case where he seems to be lying about something they actually care about, right?
Yeah.
And that might have been the first occasion where that was the case.
So I agree with you entirely on the analog. That I think that is the last time. I think it's worth pointing out that this sort of adds another layer of schadenfreudetastic deliciousness to all of this, which is that Donald Trump's bubble, like when he was, I think you're right, it was CPAC, but if it wasn't CPAC, it was TPUSA or one of those kinds of groups. His primary feedback mechanism are the extremely online ultra MAGA types, right? The people who, that's his pool of narcissists are those people. And they steer him the wrong way all the time. And sometimes, to his credit, I gotta say, he doesn't listen to him, but like he sees that crowd, those kinds of crowds, as avatars for the rank and file Republican voter. And the rank and file Republican voter, there's not a lot of polling evidence that they care much about the Epstein stuff, that they're focusing on the Epstein stuff. This is an obsession among the groups that he's obsessed with, rather than sort of the median voter. And, you know, the Democrats are trying to change that and turn it into a bigger thing. And I do not blame them in the slightest as a matter of just raw politics. But Trump would be in better shape if, you know, he stopped caring what Laura Loomer and these other gargoyles thought about stuff, because they actually, off of social media platforms, they actually don't seem to move the needle very much on public opinion. But he cares about them. Don Jr. cares about them. The people in his orbit care about them. And I think some of it is a function. I remember back when he was running for the first time in 2016, he would constantly talk about how online polls are very scientific. And the reason he thought they were scientific is that he did well in online polls. And because he invests in the shadows on the Plato's cave, he overreads their importance in all sorts of ways. It's why he puts Fox News hosts throughout his administration. He lives in this very meta sort of online, on TV universe, and he doesn't actually have good instincts for reading the normies all that well. And that's one of the reasons why this thing has gotten him into trouble, because he cares so much about their feedback that he's the one who keeps bringing it up.
Is there anyone in that orbit who's fundamentally broken with him over this? I mean, I haven't followed this that closely, but people like Tucker Carlson or Candace Owens, or I mean, they were quite disgruntled in the beginning around how, I mean, I think they deflected a lot of their blame onto Pam Bondi and Kash Patel and Dan Bongino. But has anyone just actually broken with Trump and MAGA over this? This is clearly that they've just become the swamp, and you know, the new rulers are as bad as the old rulers?
Not that I can think of off the top of my head. I mean, Charlie Kirk said shortly when this thing first started to blow up that he would never let go of this story. It's the most important story of the 20th century. Uh-huh. And then like 72 hours later, after he got a call from the White House, he's like, I'm not going to be talking about this anymore.
Right.
I try not to follow Tucker too closely, but I don't think Tucker's let go of it, but I don't think the incentives are quite there to say, I'm done with Trump. I mean, there's this dynamic that has been very common. I mean, I'm sure you've seen it 1,000 times, right? There's this, it's sort of a cliche about Jews in Tsarist Russia, where they would always say, if only the Tsar knew, right? And there's this desire to say, whenever Trump gets himself into trouble, his advisors should stop telling him this, as if he hasn't made these decisions himself, right? Falsifying Trump gets you in a lot of trouble. Saying that the people around him are in error is usually the safe harbor.
What do you think about the state of the Democratic Party at this point? I mean, as you say, they're trying to ride this political controversy to some better spot on the map. But until this moment, until the Epstein story began to cause Trump this amount of anguish, I mean, they seemed completely feckless. And I mean, it's hard to even know what they were attempting to do. It seemed like they were it was just nothing but apathy and bewilderment that had subsumed the party. I mean, it's like they were, you know, apart from the rallies that Bernie Sanders and AOC were holding that got some traction, which seemed to be pulling the party in absolutely the wrong direction for future political success. It was hard to know what anyone was attempting to do to push back against Trump in his second term. How do you view the Democratic Party at this point, and what do you think the prospects are going forward?
So Ezra Klein had this piece, which I don't think was, I'm not trying to insult Ezra. Mm-hmm. It was less that it was so insightful than it was so indicative of a mood shortly after the election, where he was lamenting the fact that given how close the presidential election was in 2024, the vibe shift is way bigger.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I mean, Kamala Harris lost by like 1.48% of the popular vote. I mean, it was not, contrary to what Trump says, it wasn't a massive landslide. The decisive nature of the swing states was a big deal. And the fact that, you know, Trump won it, you know, decisively, but not overwhelmingly. I always like to point out in speeches that Trump says it was a massive electoral college landslide. I think it ranked 44th. Is the 44th biggest electoral landslide.
Right.
So take that for what it will. But I think there was a combination of factors that it is dawned on Democrats that their theory of the case no longer works, right? The idea of how politics works, where you make appeals based upon identity politics while holding on to a significant slice of white voters who will tolerate it because they want to seem like they're decent people and are afraid of being called racist or whatever, that model kind of played itself out. And I think it's a little unfair to Kamala Harris, but she was the nail in the coffin for it. That ad with the, you know, the transgender subsidized surgery stuff, people like to talk about how that was an anti-trans ad, and sure, fine, it was an anti-trans ad. But Trump, I think, locked down the anti-trans vote a long time ago. There's a reason why he ran it 30,000 times. Right. And it was because it was the signal that, you know, the closing tagline was, she's for they, them, he's for you.
Yeah.
And that signal was the Democratic Party is so invested in the what they now call the groups, right? In this model of politics that is based upon not the actual voters, but the self-anointed representatives of the voters, right? But that Latinx stuff, normal Latinos hated it. And there's lots of polling and focus groups that showed that. But the self-anointed representatives, the diversity consultants, the experts from universities said, this is how you're inclusive. And the problem was it repelled more people than it attracted. And the problem is you've got a whole generation of Democrats who just simply don't know how to talk any other way.
Mm.
We can see this right now in this absolutely, you know, infuriating, exhausting fight over Texas redistricting, where the Democrats want I keep seeing clips of them saying that what the Republicans are doing in Texas to get five more seats with this mid-decade redistricting, which I oppose and think is just a bad violation of norms and not a good idea. But they keep wanting to say what's bad about it is that it's racist because of what it's going to do with the map. And the simple fact is that, you know, the Republicans would draw these maps to screw, you know, Subaru driving hippies in Austin just as easily as they would anybody. It's a pure power play. But the way Democrats talk is it still has to go through this sort of scrubbing of identity politics stuff that I think has just lost purchase with a lot of voters, which is one of the reasons why you saw Blacks and Latinos moving into the Trump coalition. And so they just don't have a natural, like, so their objections to a lot of the DOGE stuff were less about how it's going to affect voters and how it's going to affect normal Americans, and more about how it was being unfair to members of the sort of public sector union coalition. And I think it was representative of this problem the Democrats have is they've stopped being the party of the government, which is historically what they are. There's no shame in that. Every country needs one party that is sort of the government party. And it's been the Democrats since the New Deal. But there's a difference between being the party of what government can do for the average American and what the government can do for this big coalition of interests that are rent seekers from the government, right? Mm-hmm. Other government institutions, public sector unions, public education. I'm not saying they're all evil or anything like that, but if you go back and you watch how Biden treated the public sector unions during COVID, it was so much less about doing what was right for kids or parents, and so much more what Randy Weingartner and the teachers unions wanted. And I think voters have picked up on that. And Democrats, this is why that abundance agenda stuff that Democrats are pushing, I'm like 1.5, 2 cheers pro-abundance Democrats. The problem with it is that these guys want to clear out red tape that stops government from doing great things. The problem is it divides the Democratic coalition because the generators of 95% of that red tape are trial lawyers, teachers unions, public sector unions, environmentalists, and all these kinds of people. And so what the Democrats, I think, need, I'm not saying Rahm Emanuel is the guy to do it, but he's the guy who represents it best, is somebody who can do a sort of a Clinton thing and recognize that the way you earn credibility with voters is by, you know, sister soldier moments. It's by attacking these things that the left says are unattackable, that are sacrosanct, that are holy. And I just don't see a lot of Democrats having the skill, the muscle memory, the willingness to do anything like that. And so long as that's the case, I think they're just in a really bad place.
Do you think the woke thing is behind us on the left? I mean, do you think whoever is going to be promoted to the candidacy in 2028, however plausible, is going to be someone who is crystal clear about not being tongue-tied when asked, do you still support gender reassignment surgery for incarcerated illegal immigrants? Have we achieved peak woke and has the pendulum swung back, or do you think
I think we definitely achieved peak woke, but, you know, it's sort of like some fungal virus that you have an epidemic from. It's in the soil, so it will grow back in places, right? And, you know, campuses are still major spore centers for a lot of this stuff, and it's not going to change overnight. You know, my friend Jonathan Rauch, who's a, you know, principled man of the left, center left, I should say, he's at Brookings, good guy. You know, he has this line, I think I'm at least paraphrasing it fairly, where he says that until the Democrats can produce a candidate who is willing to say there are only two genders, male and female, and there's a second part of it, but that's the gist of it, they're going to lose. And that is not an argument for being cruel or oppressive or dismissive of trans people, but there are some issues now where I think a lot of people are just, they don't trust you unless you can say some basic truths that they believe. And I think on the trans stuff, that's one of them. I do think there are areas of race where like that sort of strategy would be bad. And I don't just mean bad for Democrats, I mean bad for the country, but like—
Can you give me an example of that? What do you think is—
Well, I mean, like there are, it's a statistical fact that African-Americans commit more crimes disproportionately than other groups. There are ways of talking about that without it sounding like you're going after Black people, right? Like race does hit the ear differently to Americans for understandable and justifiable reasons. I'm not talking about biological differences between races or any of that kind of stuff. I'm just saying—
The sociological fact that there's much more crime.
There's a sociological factor. And it's sort of, you know, I was just talking about this the other day. You know, it's funny. We're supposed to say Black and brown people, but if you say yellow people, that's racist in terms of Asians because of yellow peril and that history. And that's neither right nor wrong nor good nor bad. It's just a cultural fact, right? Is that certain connotations come up organically. For years, one of the reasons why Jews start calling themselves Jewish rather than Jew is that it's still, if you hear it today, if someone says, you Jew, it has a negative connotation to it. Right. It's irrational, but language has lots of irrationality into it. But on the issues of like transgender stuff and some of the Hispanic and Latino stuff, I think the way Democrats talk about it, that just sounds profoundly insincere and as a sop to special interests rather than the voters they claim to be speaking to.
Yeah. What do you think about the problem of inequality? There are obviously many flavors of inequality, but I'm thinking mostly wealth and income. how should we think about it and talk about it? And how much daylight is there between the optimal framing politically and ethically and what the Democrats are likely to produce?
Yeah. So I'll say this less over with my sort of CNN political commentator hat, more as my wonkish hat. I don't care very much about income inequality. I care a lot about poverty.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the problem, though, is a lot of people, it's sort of a rhetorical Trojan horse. They talk about income inequality, or they talk about economic inequality, and they want to have it both ways to say that they're also talking about poverty when the two are different things.
Dissect that a little more. I mean,
sure. Like, you could have, in theory, you could have a society where you have, where the poorest person is a millionaire, but you have a bunch of trillionaires in it.
Mm.
A lot of income inequality, it just doesn't necessarily mean that poor people are quote-unquote poor, right? And this gets complicated insofar as we do not have objective standards for poverty in the West. And I don't think we should, but I think it's useful to point out to people that our standards for poverty are not objective. If we go by the understanding, if we hold the definition of poverty constant, with the exception of like homeless people and maybe some drug addicts who are in a really bad way, we have the richest poor people in all of human history. Indeed, I mean, I wrote about this in my last book, since the pick your timeline. Since the Agricultural Revolution, since Homo sapiens split off from Cro-Magnons, the average human being everywhere in the world, ancient Rome, ancient China, South America, North America, does not matter. The average human being lived on no more than $3 a day. There's an argument. Some people say it's $6, but everybody basically agrees it was a steady state until about 300 years ago, when all of a sudden the average human being started getting richer. I think that's because of liberal democratic capitalism. We can have that conversation. But the point is, like, today, what defines poverty in the Sudan is a few dollars a day, if that. What defines poverty in the United States is the wealth of some village in Sudan. And if you define wealth, if you define middle classness today, then a lot of Rockefellers and Gettys and Vanderbilts 100 years ago were poor by today's standards.
Yeah.
So the definition of what it means to be poor changes, and it should. We should not tolerate emaciated, distended bellies of the kind you get with poor people in Sudan or Somalia or something like that in the United States. And we don't. There is not that kind of poverty here. So one of the things I think defines the way Democrats and the left talk about income inequality is that in many ways it borders on a luxury belief. What this term from Rob Henderson, where, you know, Megan McArdle was the first person who pointed out to me that a lot of center-left newspaper columnists in, you know, Washington Post, New York Times kind of columnists would define being rich as making like 10% more than the best paid newspaper columnist. And there is a lot of resentment in the sort of middle professional classes about how hard they're struggling and how easy it is at that next notch or the next two notches above, at the 1% or 2% level. And I get that. I think we have real economic problems about mobility, housing, that kind of thing, that are real. And Zoran Mandami is tapping into all that kind of stuff. But addressing income inequality isn't about poverty. And you can hear it all the time when you hear people talk about how there shouldn't be billionaires, right? Mandami says we shouldn't have billionaires. You know, Elizabeth Warren will take almost any criticism and say, oh, so you're feeling sorry for billionaires. And the simple fact is that the fact that billionaires exist isn't what is making anybody's life worth in the middle, but it pings that sort of evolutionary psychology thing about some people are taking more than their fair share of the mastodon meat. And so I'm all in favor of economic fixes that make it easier to build a home, right? That make it easier to move, that make it easier to send your kids to college. There are all sorts of things you can do within sort of mainstream economics about that. But what Mandami and that crowd are doing is they're tapping into this fundamentally tribal, religious understanding of economics that comes up every time socialism becomes popular. It's not because everyone has, you know, gone back to school and read Sidney Webb and the Fabian Socialists or Karl Marx or anything like that. It becomes popular in certain moments when people don't like the status quo and they assume, okay, the status quo is capitalism, therefore I want the opposite of capitalism. And the opposite of what would actually solve these problems isn't socialism. It's like reasonable economic policies, but we don't talk about it in those terms because we want politics to be this grander mission focused, this sort of transcendent form of social organization. And it's much more popular and appealing to young people to talk about fundamental transformation and revolution and all of these kinds of things than it is to talk to people about, you know, maybe we don't have to have an environmental impact statement for every single low-income housing unit that we build.
Mm. Yeah, well, as you point out, so much of a person's judgment of how well they're doing in life is comparative, right? So the fact that the poorest person in America, I mean, leaving aside the person actually sleeping on the sidewalk tonight, is better off than Louis XIV in many material ways, is just lost on them. And even if they think about it, it doesn't seem relevant when they can look over in their neighbor's yard and see evidence of a much easier life.
The economist Fred Hirsch in the 1970s, he came up with the concept of a positional good, which is similar to a Veblen good, but it's a little different insofar as a positional good is about status. It's about a thing that if I have it, you can't have it.
Right.
So you can only be one best basketball player in high school. And if Sam is him, then it's not me, right? That's a positional good. And part of his argument was that the desire for positional goods is why America can't promise the American dream of a middle-class life anymore, because what people are wanting is to be better off than their neighbors, than to actually have the material conditions that they're striving for. It's more about status than it is about material stuff. I think he's got a point. I'm not sure the American dream is dead or anything like that, but I think about that all the time. And it's a much more difficult thing to deal with, this desire for status, in the age of social media where everyone's curating their lives to seem like they're happier than they really are. Mm-hmm. And you feel like you're falling short of some very often just bullshit fake lifestyle.
Yeah.
And therefore you feel poorer than you actually are.
Yeah. I don't know how much time you spent around extraordinarily wealthy people who are not of the traditional. So, I mean, it used to be in the old days with—
Are you about to tell me a story about Epstein's Island?
Yeah, no, yeah.
Not that, news here?
Not that. This is less seamy than that, but still troublesome. If you go back a generation or two, the wealthiest people in America seem to clearly believe, if only for self-preservational reasons, that they had a stake in investing in the common good in some way. I mean, they put their names on the side of buildings, they bought land for public parks, et cetera. I meet a lot of wealthy people who don't seem to think that they have a stake in the public good, right? I mean, they all of their thought on this topic seems to have inclined toward their own exit strategy, right? They're just, I mean, these are the kinds of people who think about, you know, a compound in New Zealand, or they just say, I mean, I feel very cosmopolitan myself, and I do feel like I think there's something normative about thinking of oneself as a citizen of the world in many respects, right? Culturally, intellectually, morally. I mean, I wouldn't totally forego nationalism politically. I think there's an important component there. But I mean, when I think of wanting to better humanity, I think of humanity more than I think of just Americans. And yet, I mean, there's certainly a lot of rich people. There's certainly a lot of rich people in tech who, I mean, some are generous in certain modes, but there's a fair amount of cynical, narrow focus on just optimizing their lives, and a fairly explicit disavowal of philanthropy and altruism. I mean, they seem to have imbibed some of this from Ayn Rand, you know, just that altruism is just a sham, you know, it's like there's no such thing as compassion. Some of these people are just clearly missing some kind of moral module in their brains, and they just don't care about the suffering that is sufficiently distant from them, or even suffering that is right in their face. So I worry about that. I worry that we don't, it would be one thing if the soon-to-be trillionaires were obviously focused on the common good in tangible ways and disposed to make the society, even just the society around them, as good as it can be, knowing that they're already so wealthy that, you know, the amount they're going to spend on themselves, even if they buy all the boats and all the planes, is going to be a rounding error on a rounding error of their actual wealth.
So I'm going to agree and disagree with you a little bit. You know more, clearly more of the sort of nouveau riche tech world, West Coast, whatever, billionaires than I do. And I certainly grant that in that universe, the pull of Randianism is strong. Mm. I mean, I kind of miss seasteading Peter Thiel, you know? I wish he would come back more.
Yeah.
And look, if you have a lot of Randian listeners who are really into that stuff, I am fairly despised in the world of Ayn Rand. Yeah. So like, I get it.
I think I've purged them all at some point. I told them my copies of those books just simply wouldn't open. So
so I agree that's a thing out there. But where I disagree with you, or where I push back, is that I also know some high net worth people who are, some of them are jackasses, and some of them are deeply patriotic people who cared about the public good. We don't have to get into a contest of name stuff. Mm. But I also see people like Bill Gates, who you can disagree with him about one thing or another, but like he's definitely putting his money where his mouth is about things that he thinks are important, whether it's for America or for the more Diogenes-related cosmopolitans like Sam Harris or for the world, right?
Yeah.
And on climate change and disease and these kinds of things. So my point is, when I hear the left, and some people now on the right, because this horseshoe theory thing, talking about billionaires as an undifferentiated blob of people, that's where I kind of get off, right? Because my basic rule is that anytime you start arguing that a single discrete group of people are the source of our problems, that way lies bad things.
Yeah.
And that's why I don't like, you know, this guy, Joseph Uczynski, is a political scientist who studies conspiracy theories. And he's a brilliant guy. You should have him on sometime. He knows everything about everything, about conspiracy theories. But he gets in trouble with the left when he says that Bernie Sanders traffics in conspiracy theories. And he says, well, look, I have this testable definition open to everybody of what a conspiracy theory is. And I can't remember it off the top of my head, but the gist is it's a non-falsifiable theory that actors are manipulating events without evidence, something along those lines. And the way Sanders talks about millionaires and billionaires, he attributes all of our problems to this undifferentiated blob of millionaires and billionaires. And like, do you mean George Soros or do you mean the Koch brothers?
Mm.
You know, in the defense of the Kochs, you know, there are a lot of public buildings and hospitals named after the Koch, one Koch or another. So, I mean, there's still some of that going on. And the reason why I think that kind of rhetoric, and I'm not saying that you engage in it here, but like the reason why I find that kind of rhetoric problematic is that it fits the classic populist mode of, you know, in the 19th century, it was Jews or bankers or the British or the Catholic Church. But whatever it is this idea that there are string pullers, the deep state, the globalists, whoever, who are behind the scenes manipulating events. And so anytime we run into failure because our ideas don't work or don't catch on or we can't get legislation passed, it can't be because the thing we were talking about doing was actually hard or unworkable. Mm. It has to be that evil forces from behind the scenes are undermining them. For every bad billionaire is doing bad stuff on the left or bad stuff on the right or bad stuff for selfish reasons, there's probably another one who's doing something else. And better to talk about like the individual actions of people, members of a class, rather than sort of say they're the root of our problems, because I think it's kind of a conspiratorial approach to economics.
Yeah, no, I was not suggesting they're the root of any problems. What I was suggesting is culturally, I was worried that someone like Bill Gates is notable for being the outlier that he is.
That's fair.
Right?
I mean, I think that's fair.
They should all be like, I mean, I totally reject the Sanders-Warren criticism of billionaires. I think it's economically incoherent, but I mean, because we're just simply not in a zero-sum situation. I mean, the pie is getting bigger, as you pointed out, and we should want it to get bigger. And these billionaires, most of them have been instrumental in making it bigger. So
my favorite fact on that is you could literally confiscate all of the wealth of the top 1%. All of it. Not tax it more.
Literally confiscate it.
And it wouldn't pay for Medicare for All and the Green New Deal.
Right.
You know, it's just like there isn't that much money out there.
Yeah. Well, so you mentioned conspiracy theories and the people who might be pulling the strings behind the scenes to ruin everything.
Mm-hmm.
And this brings me to a final topic I want to raise with you, which is the state of anti-Semitism, left and right. And I guess we should say something about the standing of Israel now increasingly as a virtually a pariah state. Take any side of that you want. How have you been thinking about anti-Semitism and the war in Gaza and the interaction between those two facts?
Yeah, I mean, so the anti-Semitism thing is
How do you think about it? Just give me the left and the right versions of it too.
Yeah. So a lot more of it on the left is driven, I think, by attitudes towards Israel. And a lot of it on the right, and there are exceptions and to all of this, but like broad brushstrokes, a lot of it on the right is more driven by this conspiratorial mindset and this constant, endless desire to feed the vast conspiratorial bullshit industrial complex. And there's just too much ready-made, off-the-shelf, ready-to-wear garbage about Jews that people like Candace Owens and Tucker and these others can just grab off the shelf and use. And part of that then sucks in the Israel thing. And because I don't think, like, I think for good reasons and bad, and we, you know, you can do the turtles all the way down on all of these things, but for good reasons and bad, what animates a lot of people on the left and their hatred of Israel is some version of this colonial oppressor theory. It's a sometimes sincere, sometimes misguided love or sympathy for Palestinians and their role as a victim in one way or another. And I don't think there's a lot of that on the right. I don't think an enormous number of these, of the people trafficking in the anti-Semitism stuff who are coming to their Israel criticism because their heart bleeds for Palestinians. I think it's more driven by this desire to say, oh, the Jews are a fifth column. Israel gets dragged us into foreign policy. Who cares about these people in that part of the world? You know, they all suck. We shouldn't care about it, right? So it's sociologically, they're slightly different things. So that's part of it. I also think, and I've been making this argument for years now, and I will defend it against all comers, that one of the things I like to do, sort of like I think the way you approach a lot of things, is that if someone has an argument, you take their argument at face value and you apply its standards fairly and uniformly in inconvenient ways to test how much of that argument is sincere and how much it isn't. So the argument for institutional racism, right, or disparate impact or whatever we want to call it, that came up in the 60s, 70s, 80s, basically is, it was a way to explain why there were disparate outcomes for different groups, even though they couldn't find any evidence of actual discrimination, right? Why is it that blacks are underperforming in these schools? Why is it that women aren't taking these jobs in their proportionate numbers to the population? Oh, it must be these embedded institutional barriers that live like a ghost in the machine, even though the actual people running these things, we can't find any evidence that they're doing anything but. So like the argument became, look at the outcomes, not the inputs, equality of results rather than equality of, you know, of opportunity, broadly speaking. By those standards, it is just incontrovertible to me that the United Nations is structurally anti-Semitic. There's no way to get around it. If you just look at the numbers, if you go to UN Watch, they have these numbers of how many times Israel has been condemned by the Human Rights Committee. And it's more than
all the other malefactors on earth combined. I mean, Sudan and North Korea and Iran.
And all of those guys flock. It's a classic example of regulatory capture on an international stage where the worst human rights offenders grab the institution that is supposed to be regulating human rights so that they don't get attacked by it themselves. And so North Korea, Syria, all these kinds of groups, they end up on this committee and then they lecture Israel about its human rights record. And so part of it is that structure, I think, is institutionally anti-Semitic insofar as it just holds the one Jewish country in the world to a remarkably different standard than any other. And you feed into that the fact that there's an enormous amount of bad incentives for various NGOs and other groups that have monetized this larger phenomena. And it creates this atmosphere that allows you to say things about Israel and Israelis that you can monetize on a geopolitical scale that I think is just grotesque. All of that said, I just wrote about this today, you know, Yahya Alcindor, the head of Hamas who was killed last year, his whole strategy, his open strategy, his express unapologetic strategy was to use Palestinian civilians as sacrificial lambs to break the will of Israel and to engender and invite condemnation from around the world. And there are an enormous number of people, it drives me crazy, enormous number of people who treat Hamas that in some level, like it's a government. mm-hmm. that it's a state, right? But it's not. It's a prison gang that has a death cult patina to it, but it treats Palestinians as resources, as props, as human shields. It steals billions of dollars in construction materials to build bunkers to protect members of Hamas and leave the Palestinians outside. And so the upshot is that as a political reality, Israel is left in a position where they're supposed to care more about Palestinian lives than the quote-unquote government of Gaza. Mm. And that's just a disastrously difficult thing for any country to navigate. And I fear that Sinwar's strategy is posthumously starting to pay off a little bit, mm-hmm. right? You're getting these European countries saying, you know, Hamas doesn't have to do anything except maybe release the hostages. But Israel's got to provide for the care and feeding of all the Palestinians. It's got to, you know, comply with all of these rules that Hamas, by design, doesn't give a rat's ass about. And I think it's grossly unfair. I think it's structurally anti-Semitic. I think it is aided and abetted by a vast propaganda machine that a lot in the Western media fuel. Mm-hmm. At the same time, it's a political reality. And I think that as problematic as it is, that unless Israel has one more magic move up its sleeve that we don't know about, I think it should end the war for now. I mean, I have nothing but sympathy for the Palestinians who are suffering, but that's not the reason why I think they should end the war. If you told me 7 more days of this and they could kill every last member of Hamas, go for it, right? I mean, it's a prudential question to me.
Yeah.
But we're at this point where the propaganda and the double standards are swamping any other consideration, and Israel, I think, needs to take that into account.
Is there anything fundamentally different do you think they should have done in light of how fully the deck has been stacked against them politically? I mean, like many people have pointed out that abridging the food aid on any level at any point was always going to be counterproductive. I mean, what you wanted to do was just flood the place with food so that it could never be claimed of you that you were using starvation as a weapon of war.
Yeah. So I know a lot of Israelis I trust and students of Israel who I trust who make this point that it was that decision, I think it was March, to cut off the food and stop working with those NGOs. And this is a perfect example of sort of the larger thing that I'm talking about. Those NGOs are in bed with Hamas.
Yeah.
Those NGOs are in bed with a lot of bad actors, and Hamas gets its cut, and it uses food as a currency inside of Gaza to maintain power. And so I understand the arguments for trying to cut out those NGOs. Mm. The problem is that they didn't do it well. And maybe it was not possible to do well, but it created a political reality, which is real suffering. The suffering from hunger, it's not famine. And even the UN basically it came short of saying it was famine, saying it's on its way to famine, mm-hmm. which is a different thing. But that always gets truncated, say, UN says famine. The fact that the New York Times struggled so mightily to find an emaciated kid mm-hmm. that didn't have some congenital, you know, pre-existing condition and couldn't find one tells you it's not famine, right? Famine's mm-hmm. a plural word. It means if there was real famine, it wouldn't be hard to find examples of it. But there are easy examples of hunger. Prices for food are going skyrocketing in Hamas. There's real suffering. And so, yes, I think if you had to do it all over again, I would have figured out a way not to make the criticisms of Israel easier and not to, you know, again, increase suffering in Gaza. I think the food argument is a good one. I mean, you and I were thousands of miles away here. It's very difficult for me to say, oh, here's how you distribute food mm-hmm. in Gaza in a way that cuts Hamas out and serves the needs of the people without it seeming like Israel's using food as a weapon. I don't know what that way is, but it would have been better, I think, if they had done something like that.
Yeah, yeah. How concerned are you about anti-Semitism for Jews living outside of Israel? Like the character of life in a city like London, say, or Toronto, or I mean, I guess, you know, the state. I think it's probably less of a problem in the States, but still, it just seems like this is a different moment where I lived virtually my entire life thinking that anti-Semitism was a variable that was almost entirely in the rearview mirror, apart from, you know, the mad work done by Islamists and jihadists the world over. But I can't really say that now, post October 8th. What are your thoughts there?
So I worry about it greatly. I had Russ Roberts, who's the president of Shalom College in Israel, on my podcast this week, and he was recounting stories that are very widely discussed in Israel that I had missed about events in Spain and in various places. It's bad out there. And this kind of brings us back to the highfalutin conversation we had at the beginning, insofar as, you know, the fundamental essence of liberalism is, again, I don't mean Democratic Party, I mean like liberal democratic capitalism, mm-hmm. liberalism of the liberal arts, is that you judge people by their individual actions, their individual statements. It is quintessential racism to say that all Black people are alike, all Asian people are alike, all, you know, that is that sort of collective thinking, that tribal thinking that sees identity politics groups as interchangeable, commodified things is the standard way in terms of evolutionary psychology human beings were brought up to believe. Is everybody in my tribe is human. The people in the other tribe, they're barely human and they're definitely the enemy. And one of the things you see throughout European history is that whenever things went bad in the Holy Land, Jews in Europe got a rough time for it because there was this idea that you're all in on it together. And if there's a more antiquated idea about how to see the world than this idea of the Jews are doing something bad, real or alleged, right? 1,000 or 10,000 miles away, let's go beat up that Jewish old man here as payback. And whenever you have societies that get illiberal, right? Whenever you have societies that fall back into this lizard-brained tribal kind of thinking, it's going to hit Jews hard. Because there's no way of thinking in the, you know, it's all about groups mindset without it reflecting badly on Jews. And in part because there's just so much built up cultural baggage and BS that people can just grab to utilize to turbocharge their thinking on this. And in part because there's some great books about this by Jerry Mueller about Jews get it coming and going, right? They're too capitalist and they're too communist. Mm-hmm. You know, they're too clannish and they're too cosmopolitan. There's something about Jews that gives something to everybody who wants to see the world that way, something to work with. And so the more we descend into a illiberal age, the more that these sort of ancient ways of thinking become accepted as the new modernity, the worse it's going to be for Jews. Now, that doesn't mean we're going to get another Holocaust or anything like that, but I worry about it, you know, and I worry about it. I worry about it for my daughter, and I worry about it for Western societies, broadly speaking, because when societies start looking for any scapegoats, they get into trouble. But there is something kind of special about looking for Jews as scapegoats, in part because of what Jews represent inside of Western civilization and sort of bourgeois values and all these kinds of things. And you start talking about Jewish values as being bad, you start talking about the kind of values that I think are the biggest wellsprings of health for society in many ways. And I'm not saying that Jews do everything better. I'm just saying that the emphasis on education, the emphasis on family, the emphasis on good works, the emphasis on learning, all of these kinds of things, it's sort of like the arguments where people say, oh, you shouldn't act white in school. It's like, I think that's the most evil way of talking about things because it closes off the success sequence and the modes of prosperity for other groups just because they're not white. And when you start trying to say that Jews represent all that is bad, you're really trying to say that a lot of what is great about Western civilization is bad. And that leads to nowhere good either.
Well, Jonah, you embody so much that is good about Western civilization. So I just say, keep it up. It's great to talk to you.
It's great to be here. Thank you for having me back. One of the best things about being on this podcast is like, it's sort of like after years of never being on like Meet the Press, you go on Meet the Press and all of a sudden you're hearing from cousins and dentists forgot that you ever existed, but like you have a listenership that doesn't overlap with a lot of the places where I am. So it's always great to see, hear from people who are like, oh, I saw you on the Sam Harris podcast.
The dentists out there, we need you to keep it up. Thank you, Jonah.
Thank you, man. Appreciate it.